الرحمن الرحیم و بین استعین. عرض سلام و ادب داریم خدمت شما.
In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate, greetings to you and condolences on the days of Muharram. Recently, there was an interview with the Hezbollah Secretary General. It was the topic of the 33-day war, and that was actually marked the major developments in the region and in the and also with respect to the resistance front. So, as the commander of the IRGC Quds Force, and you were present in the region, so we are eager to hear your analysis of the event. As the commander of the Quds Force, so far you have had no interview, and this is your first. This is going to be your first interview. So, as the first question, I wish to learn about the grounds that led to the 33-day war, particularly 5 years after the presence of the United States in the region, in the countries of Iraq and Afghanistan. In the name of God, the Merciful, the Compassionate, all praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon God's Messenger and upon His Immaculate Household. To answer your question, I should say that the 33-day war had some hidden causes, some covert causes, which were the principal factors leading to the war. And the war had some apparent causes, the pretext of which were the hidden goals that the Zionist regime sought for a period of time. When I speak of the covert factors, we had some intelligence about the preparations of the Zionist regime, but we had no intelligence on the fact that the enemy wanted to launch an attack in ambush. Later, based on two circumstances, we concluded that prior to this war, a swift ambush was supposed to be conducted to overturn Hezbollah. Well, this war happened when two important events, one concerning the entire region and another exclusively concerning the Zionist regime, were taking place. In the event concerning the region following the 9/11, the United States had extensively developed the presence of its armed forces in our region, as much as was the case during World War II. And that includes its quantitative aspect rather than its qualitative aspect. In 1991, when there was the attack by Saddam attacking Kuwait, the first U.S. attack took place, the United States invasion, and Saddam's defeat left military remainders in our region, leading to the settlement of a U.S. military base. But after the 9/11, due to two heavy military assaults by the United States, about 40% of the armed forces in the disposition of the United States entered our region. And later, gradually, as a result of the changes, even reserve forces, as well as the National Guard, got involved. And that is to say, approximately over 60% of the U.S. Army, including they were deployed to our region. Therefore, there was a major presence from the quantitative point of view. There were in Iraq alone, there were more than 150,000 troops, and over 30,000 U.S. forces were stationed in Afghanistan. So this was, with the exception of the coalition forces, that were about 15,000 in Afghanistan. Thus, a 200,000 member specialized and trained forces were present in our region next to Palestine. This presence naturally provided certain opportunities for the Zionist regime. That is, the presence of the U.S. in Iraq was an obstacle to the movement and the dynamism of the Syrians in Syria, as well as a threat to the Syrian government and a threat to Iran. So, if you look at the Iraq geography, you see that during the war in 2006 and the 33-day war, you see this geography that is a connection to the mother of resistance, and the Americans have deployed 200,000 troops and hundreds of aircraft and copters, as well as thousands of military pieces of military hardware have been deployed to the region. So this naturally provided the Zionist regime with an opportunity to take advantage of this situation and take up action. The grandeur supposedly frightened Iran, frightened Syria. So these two governments wouldn't take actions. So based on this assumption, the Zionist regime, especially due to the approach of the Bush administration, that was hardliner government and that adopted hasty decisions with the team that existed at the White House supporting the Zionist regime. Hence, the Zionist regime found this situation suitable for taking action. The principal route, therefore, lied in the Zionist regime seeking advantage from the U.S. military presence in the region, from Saddam's fall, from the initial victory of the United States in Afghanistan, and the fear that the United States had created in the region by considering a major range of political groups of the region and the world as terrorist groups if they were deemed as opposing the U.S. policies. The Zionist regime wanted to take advantage of this, thinking it was the best opportunity for a war because the Zionist regime had suffered a defeat in 2000 and had retreated from Lebanon and had actually fled and escaped from Lebanon. Hezbollah had defeated the Zionist regime, so it wanted to go back rather to alter the to demolish and alter the demography in southern Lebanon. This was revealed during the war. So the main goal was to completely change the demography so that the people living in southern Lebanon who had come would be moved out of Lebanon. And the Zionist regime sought to implement the same plan as what happened after 1967 to the Palestinians. to force people to evacuate. They forced the Palestinians to exit southern Lebanon, to settle in various refugee camps. And even Arafat was obliged to relocate his major place of activity from Lebanon to Tunisia in Maghreb. The same assumption existed about the Shia community of Lebanon. So now I will move from the background prior to the war to the period during the war to complete the discussion. On this matter, the U.S. and Israeli officials have two important statements. On the early days of the war, Bush used inappropriate words. His microphone was turned on, but the words he used are at his own level. I won't repeat them. He said this in support of the aftermath of the war, not the war itself. And Rice used more polite and diplomatic words. She said it when the massacres culminated in south of Lebanon. And there were acts of massacre. And there were murders that were committed. And she used the word, she used an analogy describing the halls with blatant words, describing it as the birth pangs of the Middle East. She drew an analogy between the cries of the innocent children, women, and innocent people from under the rubbles and the birth pangs of a major event. Therefore, these remarks indicated that there's been a major scheme being designed. But as for the Zionist regime, the regime had prepared a big camp and a number of ships. The camp was provided to initially transfer the people they captured, as many as they could, to camp inside Palestine, which was estimated to house up to 30,000 people. Then they planned to send those who were ordinary civilians to other places, to other countries. And abduct those who were considered convicts in their view or had some organizational affiliations with the Hezbollah. They had prepared ships for the migration of the people. Therefore, unlike other wars that affect all similarly, this war at this stage was done precisely using technology. That is, the war targeted one single community. At first, they tried to limit it to a party, namely Hezbollah. Later, it was expanded to include all the Shia community in southern Lebanon to completely change the demography of the south. Therefore, speaking of the covert root causes of the war, as they also confessed later, when Ehud Olmert and later the Minister of Defense and the head of the Joint Chief of Staff said that they intended to conduct a raid or to launch an ambush, if the ambush had happened, the major part of Hezbollah's The major part of Hezbollah would have been destroyed by a massive strike. In the first decision, Hezbollah would have suffered severe damage to at least 30% of its main organization. Then in the next stages, they would have inflicted destruction. But the basic factor was taking advantage from the powerful presence of the United States in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and in the region, as well as Arab countries, other Arab countries' willingness to support Israel in such a war to uproot Hezbollah or the Shia community in southern Lebanon. This was mentioned by Olmert. He said that for the first time, all Arab countries, by all Arab states, he meant the majority of the Arab countries, namely the Cooperation Council for the Arab States of the Persian Gulf, was in particular considered. And other countries were generally not exceptions. Yet we could find a few exceptions at that time. You know, Iraq had no governing body at that time. The ruler of Iraq at the time was Bremer, the U.S. military ruler. The Syrian government was a young government due to the passing away of Hafez al-Assad, and that just started working. So when he said all countries, he meant that majority. So he said that for the first time, all the Arab countries supported Israel in the war against an Arab organization. So what he said was the expression of a reality. Therefore, we should consider three covert factors with respect to the war. First, the opportunity provided by the presence of the U.S., the reigning of the U.S. in Iraq, and the fear the extensive presence of the United States had caused in the region. Second, willingness of Arab countries and their discreet announcement of cooperation with the Zionist regime for obliterating the Hezbollah and changing the demography in southern Lebanon. Third, the goals the Zionist regime pursued by taking advantage of this opportunity in order to get rid of the Hezbollah forever. These three factors represented the main hidden goals or intentions that played a crucial role with respect to the root causes of this conflict. Thank you very much. You mentioned the covert factors behind the war, so would you please elaborate on the apparent reasons that led to the war? Speaking of the open pretext, apparently the Hezbollah had a commitment towards the Lebanese people, and the Hezbollah was committed to the Lebanese people, and there was no other power apart from the Hezbollah who could fulfill that commitment. To free the young Lebanese imprisoned and captured by the Zionist regime. Sayed promised this in one of his speeches, saying they will surely free the Lebanese prisoners from the Zionist regime, as they had done so previously to the Lebanese people, including the Druze Muslim and Christian prisoners. had no hope or heaven apart from the Hezbollah. So do they today? In any event, the main refuge of the Lebanese people in defense against the violent regime has been the Hezbollah. In the previous swaps, Israel refused to deliver the main prisoners, some of whom were teenagers. And these teenagers spent their lives in prisons and had grown into young and middle-aged adults. The Hezbollah promised to liberate them, but it was not realized at the first swap, as Israel refused to free them. Therefore, in order to realize the promise, the Hezbollah engaged in an operational action to carry out the swap, which was later realized. So a special operation was performed. And I don't know what title can describe him. I wonder if I can use the title the general, which has become popular today. Now the titles general and brigadier general are often used in our country, but he was truly a general, Martyr Emad Mogdia. He was a general with the most similar features to Malik Ashtar on the battlefield. On his martyrdom, and as the feeling experienced on the martyrdom of Malik was now felt by martyrdom Malik, Imam Ali was grieved and sorrowed, and he cried while giving a speech. Some hadith narrate where he said, Malik, for me, was like, Imam Ali said that Malik, for me, was like the prophet. He said that Malik, for me, was like I was for the messenger of Allah. And he said that, well, women deliver children who will ever again grow into someone like Malik. So he was the commander, and he was the commander of this operation. And he actually supervised the implementation of the operation, and the operation proved to be successful. And he managed to attack a vehicle of the Zionist regime inside the occupied lands and capture two wounded persons from inside the vehicle. There were three, of course. These were three operations, not just one operation. So, in fact, the operation had to be designed, and in fact, there were barbed wires, and one had to just passed through these barbed wires. In fact, it was not just destruction. One had to cross over and just take back the prisoners. So the operation had to be done with precision. And in fact, it had to take place quite swiftly. It was just talk of moments, few moments. So and the enemy was just a few minutes away from the place of operation. So the third operation was to just bring the prisoners to a safe place.
جنگ با همین بهانه آغاز شد.
So that was the pretext for the start of the war, and there was a major assault on Hezbollah positions. So what was the reaction of the Lebanese Hezbollah in the very first hours, in the early hours, particularly with respect to the fact that Israel had used the pretext for this? I have to mention two points.
Hezbollah به دلیل اینکه یک پیوستگی داره با یک دشمنی که غیر قابل سازش.
So Hezbollah is actually facing an enemy that cannot be compromised. So from the view of political logic and beliefs, one cannot reach a compromise with the enemy, and the enemy also believes that it cannot compromise with the Hezbollah. So this is a continuous enmity. So it was a continuous enmity, and therefore the Hezbollah was in the full preparedness for the sake of defense. So the Hezbollah was in a state of preparedness. So the operation led to the enhancement of awareness, and there had already been preparedness amongst the military forces, and currently the Hezbollah is in full preparedness. It cannot be compared to other types of preparations to have, for example, to have a yellow notice or red notice or so on. In other words, the Hezbollah is 100% prepared, and at that time and also today there's been 100% preparedness, and of course the quality differs due to the volume of the equipment. So whatever the Hezbollah wants to carry out an action, first there should be some security arrangements before taking any action. Therefore, when the Hezbollah decided to carry out the operation for capturing two Zionist regime soldiers for that important swap, first it became prepared internally. So it had two aspects. One was preparation for combat, and also preparation for reducing the damage. So when the regime conducted the operation, particularly in the early days, there was a data bank ready from the past, and the data bank was handed over to the Air Force. And on the basis of the data bank that just elaborated on the coordinates of the Hezbollah, it took action. But due to the arrangements by the Hezbollah, from the view of the manpower and also its equipment, it was the amount of damage was minimized. I can tell you that in the early moments there was no damage, and when the enemy announced that the data bank of targets has been finished, that meaning that it has targeted all the targets related to the Hezbollah, it was later revealed that what had been done were in contravention with the expectations of the initiatives by the Hezbollah prior to the operation, and the Hezbollah had made some predictions about the enemy. So that was the first one. Second, now, in the predictions related to the war, in such cases, it never led to a complete war. That means that there was, for example, a one-day conflict, and various areas were targeted with high intensity, and then it came to a halt. But in the early moments, the premeditated operation was fully implemented. In other words, the scheme they wanted to implement covertly, they were fully implemented. I used at that time, these were covert schemes, and I will later elaborate on this. After 2 weeks, based on our beliefs, not based on intelligence. Almost at the end of the war, we realized that the enemy had a plan and they wanted to lay an ambush. And a major part of our perception and understanding was due to the announcements made by the enemy. Therefore, the war turned into a full-fledged war very quickly. Like a warehouse housing a great deal of munitions that were suddenly set on fire. So there was a huge explosion known as the 33-day war. So when the event took place, on the first day I returned to Lebanon, because I was there one day before, I returned to Syria, and because all the routes had been attacked, particularly the Lebanon-Syria passageway, it was under the fire of airplane, under the fire by airplanes, and the airplanes did not leave the area. So we had a safe contact, and Emad came after me, and there was another route. We had to even walk on foot, and I was transferred to Lebanon. The war focused on the administrative buildings of the Hezbollah in the south, mostly in the south, and also some other points in the middle and the northern parts. So in the first week, was asked to come to Tehran to provide explanation. And at that time, the leader was in Mashhad. I went to the leader and the head of the three branches and the senior officials were members of the National Security Council, Supreme National Security Council, and the intelligence officials there were all invited, and I presented a report about the event, and my report was a bitter one. In other words, my observations did not depict a very bright picture for victory, and the war was a different one, and it was a precise war, and advanced technologies were used, and a single bomb could flatten a 12-story building. And the targets were chosen very precisely, and even villages that were very close to one another. It's difficult to ask for the artillery because the war had transferred from the Hezbollah to tribes, a village inhabited by Shiites, and another village inhabited by Sunni or Christian brothers. They were quite different. In one village, one was sitting smoking, and in another village, there were several thousand bullets and shells just targeting that village. I did present a report at that meeting, and there was the time for prayers, and everybody went to perform the an act of ablution, and the leader also performed an act of ablution, and as he was returning, he told me to go to him, and the leader said, "You wanted to say something to me," and I said, "No, I just wanted to explain the reality." And the leader said, "I understood this. Didn't you want to tell me anything else?" I said, "No." We performed the prayers and we returned to the meeting, and my report had ended. Then the leader started just offering his remarks. He made some statements, and he stated that the points mentioned were true, and this is a very difficult war, but I believe that this war is similar to the Khandaq battle, and the verses related to Ahzab chapter that were recited by the leader, and the feelings of the Prophet, his companions. Then he said that my perception is that the victory in this war will be similar to the victory of the Khandaq battle. I was moved by his remarks because materially speaking, I did not have such an assumption. And deep in my heart, I had a feeling that I wished that the leader had not made such a statement. Then he mentioned two other points that were quite important. One point was that the leader said that I believe that
در تجربه این 20 سالی که در معذر آقا بودم نتیجه تقوا را
I personally do believe in virtue, because virtue will turn into wisdom, that will dominate one's heart and mind. And I did just see this. I just saw this happening.
یا بر چیزی یقین میکنم میکنند مطمئن میشم در اون چیزی به دست میارم.
And when the leader is certain about something, I am assured that there will be an accomplishment. The leader said that
اسرائیل,
my assumption is that Israel had prepared this scheme in the past and wanted to just implement this scheme in a surprise move, and in this way destroy the Hezbollah. And the move by the Hezbollah for capturing, for taking these two captives, just disrupted that surprise move. And I didn't have this information. Emma didn't have it. None of us had such information. Because they were at the border and they could see. So this was quite promising for me because it was quite helpful for Sayed, and it had there was an intensification of the conflict. There was more destruction. There were more martyrs, and Sayed made remarks that made me regretful, and I don't want to repeat them. And I had the feeling that some may blame, saying that how come the Hezbollah, in order to take two captives, how come it has endangered the all Shias? But the Hezbollah, by taking back two prisoners. In fact, the Hezbollah managed to save the Lebanese people, and this was quite promising. A third point was also said that had a spiritual aspect. The leaders told me to tell them to perform this supplication of Joshan Saghir. And Joshan Kabir is more famous for Shiites, and Joshan Saghir supplication doesn't have such a reputation for the masses. The leader further explained this so that we would have the right perception with respect to the contents of Joshan Saghir supplication, because some say that, for example, by reciting this particular verse or chapter of the Holy Quran, the problem will be resolved. He said that Joshan Saghir supplication shows the feeling of an anxious person, a person who has anxiety and wants to talk to God. And that night I just left Tehran for Syria, but I had a very good feeling. In fact, I was conveying something for the Sayyid that was actually the most valuable thing. Emad came after me, and we returned. I went to Sayyid, and I quoted the statement for him. And these words were quite effective, and he has a particular characteristic, and we have not reached that point. And I think he is the one who can guide us with respect to Velayat Faqih, because he has a strong belief in the remarks by the leader. And considers his remarks as being divine remarks.
کلمه ای که از ناحیه
And therefore, he pays close attention to the remarks by the leader. I explained this to him and he was delighted. And the fact that the victory will be similar to the Khandaq battle that has many hardships. And it's going to be a major victory. I quoted the leader, and this was actually propagated amongst all the combatants. So there were some who were fighting the enemy face to face, and also other fronts. And the analysis that the enemy had a premeditated plan, and this became the basis for the Sayyid operation for in order to justify the public opinion and drawing the people's attention to the intentions of the enemy. Regarding the third point, everybody paid more attention to Joshan Sagir's application because it has spiritual content. And it's one of the best supplications in Mafati, which has a divine content.
It was regularly broadcast on Al Manar TV with a great intonation. And even it was in Messiah supplications because it is a divine, a spiritual one. It does not belong to only one tribe. Anybody who has servitude to God and anybody who believes in the Almighty to God, it would have an impact on him. So basically, this was the beginning of another movement. Actually, we can say it was a new blood into the veins of Hezbollah. Hezbollah with a greater morale, with a greater self-confidence, entered the battle with the enemy. I didn't come back until the end of the battle. I was there for the full 33 days in Lebanon. After the war ended, I returned home again in a similar meeting to Mashhad meeting, but in Tehran, before the leader of the Islamic Revolution, where all the commanders were there. I submitted a report. Part of it had been published before. I used to relay reports of the battlefield, and so they were aware of the details. Inside Iran, especially among the officials of the Islamic Republic, were there differences about how to tackle the 33-day war, or all the officials were seeing eye to eye? No, in that juncture, there was no difference in the point of view. Everybody was seeing the issue the same, including the spiritual support and also the financial and armed support and equipment support, the facilities, media support, anything within the framework of the capabilities of the Islamic Republic. Inside the establishment, nobody was feeling any doubt about that, at least in that juncture, because I was there. And when I was hearing about what is happening here, there was no concern about that. There was a complete unity about the support for Hezbollah, and the attempt for the victory of Hezbollah was completely here to the very true sense of the word. And at that time, we can say that the core center of that support was the leader of the Islamic Revolution on a steering at the expediency of the Islamic Republic and the Muslim nations. There was no doubt the issue of Hezbollah and the issues relating to Hezbollah. There may be some differences, but for Hezbollah, there has not been a doubt. There has been complete unity. So, from the perspective of the operations of the 33-day war, there has been not a lot of words. And if there has been something, it's been about the situation of the Israeli regime. And you, as somebody who has been in the battlefield and you'll be present in the scene, could you please give us some of the details of the strategic operations of Hezbollah? You see, still, there are some issues surrounding the 33-day war that we cannot talk about them. This is despite the fact that close to 13 years have passed since the beginning of the war. Still, there is time so that some of the secrets of the war should be remain confidential. But the parts that we can talk about and they are useful, I can say that some points are important, and I want to tell you some memory notes. Actually, Hezbollah had an operation center in Zahia, which generally and consistently the buildings surrounding that were bombed and destroyed. Any night, two or three high-rise buildings, 12-floor buildings, 13-floor buildings, not more than 15-floor buildings are there. They were razed to the ground, totally leveled to the ground. One night, when we were in the operation center, all the officials who were responsible for commanding the war were there. It was a very normal building and room, but some of the equipment for telecommunication and connections were equipped were there so that we could have connection with different parts. I felt that after the buildings surrounding us were destroyed, it was night, close to 11 p.m., I felt that there was a very serious danger for Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, so I decided to relocate him. Me and Ahmad, we came to this conclusion. Sayyid Nasrullah was very reluctant to get out of the room. It was not a decision to get out of that building, get out of the Zahia. From the building that we were feeling that there was a danger posing there, and Israeli drones were consistently flying over Zahia and three by three, and they were accurately controlling the movements, even a motorcycle that was moving. So they were tracking that. So at 12 a.m. in Zahia, it was totally dark. It was like nobody was living there in the center of Zahia, which was the main stronghold of Hezbollah. So we decided that we transfer Sayyid from one building to another. So we did that. There was not a long distance between the two. So when we did that, immediately after getting into that building, there was another bombardment. and they hit this the vicinity of this of that building, of the new building. So we waited because we had a communication. We didn't want to lose that communication. Again, there was another bombardment. There was a bridge beside the building, so they targeted that building. So we were feeling that these two bombings were about to be followed by a third one. So in that building, there were only three people, me and Sayed and Aman. So we decided to get out of the building, to go into another building. So we got out, three of us. We didn't have a car. Zahia was totally dark. And there was complete silence. Just the aircraft of the Israeli regime flying over Zahia. So I was wearing a military camouflage clothes. I took off my clothes, but underneath that it was my personal clothes, but my pants were still of the uniforms, me, Sayed, and Ahmad. Ahmad told me and Sayed and asked us to sit under a tree. It was night and there was no shade. Just he wanted to make us hide from the cameras. It didn't do so because the cameras of the aircraft would track humans based on the heat guidance. So they would track us and spot us. So we sat there, and I remembered the story of Muslim, not for me, for Sayed. Sayed was the owner of that area. Ahmad left very quickly, found a car, maybe less than a few minutes, quickly came back. It was unique in planning. When the car got to us, on that time, it was MCA was on us. So when the car was there, MCA actually directed at the car. So that aircraft would transfer the information in their operation and control room. So it took time so that we could, with going to the basement and from one basement to another, and then transfer from one room car to another, which I cannot say now, so that we could be able to mislead to the enemy, and so that we could come back to the operation room again. The important note that was there was that usually during wars, there is a great speed. I've been into military and security issues for 40 years. I understand that. There is great speed and quickness in the war. And there is a need so that they would show their capabilities very quickly. Hezbollah in that war, in any stages of it, with a new move, took the enemy by surprise. They didn't reveal all their capabilities and equipment in one stage. So Sayed was saying something which would keep the enemy into horror. Stage by stage, Haifa stage, and after that, the post-Haifa stage, and then the post-post-Haifa stage, they continued with that so that they would make the enemy understand that there was a new and arm and coming. They showed their power in making the enemy be taken by surprise. So the enemy was certain that Hezbollah in that time, in 2006, had the capability of going over a new stage, which was a red stage and a more dangerous stage, and dragging the war into Tel Aviv. This was obvious in Hezbollah. So therefore, one of the moves by Hezbollah was that it was psychological beside being military. It was both a military operation, any stage, in any geographical spot in the Palestinian occupied territories, which was challenging for the enemy, and also from the psychological side, the enemy was taken by delirium. The next point is that the application of the tools, the enemy was of this opinion that they had taken the capability of Hezbollah into zero, or at least the minimum. In any stage, when the enemy was announcing that Hezbollah was depleted of their arms, Hezbollah in that day and the day after, they launched missile attacks multiple times more than the previous levels. It was not simple. When a land from air, a dynamic artillery force was moving, they wanted to get out of the defensive stage and to also target and not be harmed, and getting back to the practical level, it was very difficult. But because of the agility existent among the Hezbollah fighters, which had been gained by extensive rehearsals and practices from 2000 to 2006, from the time the Israeli regime had escaped this southern Lebanon, these exercises up to 2006, based on a plan called Seyed al-Shuhada, was consistent. And the designer of that plan was Emad. So he had done a very great arrangement about how to be tackling the enemy. The third point was that the strategy by Hezbollah, in contrary to the other wars, because wars have a forefront, this war didn't have a forefront. Any point of it was a dam. You know, any point from the point that was the line between the occupied Palestinian territories to Lebanon, at least to Litani, any spot of it, any hill, any house, it was the forefront, it was the trench. Not a famous, obvious one that we see in regular wars. We had them in our wars, we used them. No, it was a special strategy. If we want to assume all these strategies of Hezbollah's, they were actually similar to a vast mining field, a smart, vast mining field, in which there was no empty and immune spot. So if you look at the movement of the enemy and you see that the enemy in some parts, like villages, the villages adjacent to the border, like Itashab, they were unable to enter those villages. They couldn't. They were unable to enter the cities too. So they decided finally to go and use the eastern gate to enter Litani, which was the vulnerable point of theirs. and their defeat. A great important issue in the war was that one strike by Hezbollah, like the strike by Imam Ali in Khandaq battlefield and battled, in taking down Umar ibn Abdawad. Why? Because it saved Islam. Hezbollah, in the strikes that it had designed, some of the strikes were one time would take down the enemy. One of them was the naval force of the regime. You know that for getting to the south, there was only one connecting line, and that line was on the bank of the Mediterranean, and then goes to Sur, and then it goes to the front. In all wars, the Israeli regime, its frigates, they would stay there and they would close the lines by their artillery. And they would do so in the war, in the first days of the war. So what the enemy was not aware and how Hezbollah took the enemy by surprise was the marine missiles. In those days, they wanted to test the marine missiles. Before that, all the missiles were hidden and they would be launched in hidden areas. The operation was very tough. When the missiles would get out of a hideout and a car would transfer it, there was a launching pad which was obvious. So there were 4 and 5 frigates of the Israeli Navy was there. So that was when Sayed and Emad concluded and agreed that the rumor was spreading that Sayed had been injured. There was a very public worry in Lebanon. He had to talk. Until that day, the enemy, until that week, the enemy had the upper hand. We had not done a great thing apart from the missile thing, so we had to do that. Multiple times, the missile came into the launching pad and it was ready to launch, and there was a problem in the launching and in the firing. So Sayed wanted to say in his speech as a, in Arabic, it was a surprise speech, a surprising, significant move. We got to the end of Sayed's speech. Sayed's speech had to be recorded and then published later. Like now that you are listening to me and you're recording my speech, and then you will remove some parts, and then, or you will show it to me myself, and then I will cut some parts out. So we were sitting there. There was conflict. When the missile was not firing, when we were getting to the end of Sayed Nasrullah's speech, so before ending his speech, the missile was fired. The speed of the missile, it was supersonic, and it targeted it very quickly. So Sayed, at the end of his speech, it was like a speech from the hidden, and he was just saying that you are now seeing yourself that the Israeli frigate is burning. So this words by Sayed Nasrullah and the targeting of the warship they were totally simultaneous. So maybe it's believing this in this is a little difficult, but based on what God did and how this strike targeted its designated aims, it was, you know, the with considering the fact that those warships have jammers, they have defense capabilities, but the missile hit the warship and it cut it into two. So this was something that we didn't see it until the end of the war, that with a missile all the Israeli Navy was out of the system and out of the scene. It deserves a lot of analysis. One part is the capability of the Israeli regime, of the Zionist regime, a regime with that has its navy out with just a missile. It's clear that when they have as many as warships, they would also get out their warships with more missiles. It was in a 100 range target, and in the next stage it could be with 200 or 300 meter range. So this was a miracle, this was a victory, a huge victory. The people who in that stage were displaced or they were under bombardment, just at the time of the bombardments, they were shouting Allahu Akbar based on the delight. This was another surprising move by Hezbollah. So they turned the balance. The regime was unable to make up for this until they came to Khiyam Plain and they moved toward Lithuania. It was 28th, 27th day of the war, very tough days. I left Emad. We were in one area. Sayed was in another area. Every night we would have meetings with specific principles. We would get to Sayed, we would have meetings, and Emad would give the complete reports, the whatever Sayed had in his mind, he would receive them. It was 20th to 28th days, very tough days and very heavy days. We can say they were among the toughest days of the 33-day war. Some issues cannot be explained here about how Sayed was feeling. Emad had a very significant initiative, and that initiative was very influential. If I want to assess the influence of that move, I can resemble it to a message and a promise that the leader had. It was as significant as that. And that was the letter of the fighters, of the captivated fighters under bombardments, addressing Sayed Hassan. It was a very surprising letter. When the letter was being read by Emad, who was the designer, he was crying out loud, and I didn't see anybody reading that letter and not crying. And more important than that was the response by Sayed. You know, if we want to resemble it to something, we can say it was close to the poems that Imam Hussein's followers were reciting before enemy in defense of Imam Hussein, and Sayyid's words in steadfastness and in appreciation and in glorification of his followers and his fighters, it was close to what Imam Hussein was telling his followers and supporters and companions. All those words were very and highly influential, and we can say they were totally divine, those words and those writings from the side of the fighters in the battlefield, and the response by Sayyid. It had a great influence, and it had a very high spirit and morale. From the 28th day, the balance of war was changed. And here I have to say that if you broadcast this, I want to beg anybody who is listening, we had a lot of these scenes in our holy sacred, in our sacred defense. I'm always saying that one of the points that we had in the war, the morale that our fighters had during the war with Iraq, it was a state of spirituality. It was, there were some words beyond the veils, beyond the what can be seen. There was, once we were in Chalamche, we wanted to launch an operation before Karbala 5 operation. It was 1 year and a half before that. So there, when we wanted to hide that from the enemy, we designated some information and operation forces, and they were deployed there. So in front of us, there was water. There, two of our fighters were there for reconnaissance, but they couldn't come back. There was a comrade of ours who was very spiritual. He was a schoolboy, was a student, but very spiritual and very godly. We couldn't find like him. He was unique. He had gotten to a stage which we can say that the scholars and the people who are exemplary in that area, they get to a point after 80 years. He had gotten to that point. He called me and asked me to go to him, and I did. So I was in Ahvaz, and when this call happened, I went there, and he told me Akbar Musayipur and Sadiqi has not, they have not returned. I was very sad. I was saying that we are just at the beginning, and we had some war prisoners. So the operation had been revealed, and it was by anger.
He said that Akbar Musayipur will return tomorrow. And his name was Hussein. And I said, I used the word, and I shouldn't say that now. I can quite remember he had a smile on his face, and he said that Hussein, the son of Ghulam Hussein, is saying this to you. And his father was a hardworking teacher. His mother was also a teacher, and his mother and father were teachers. And even though he was a teenager, he was like a teacher. There were hundreds of persons whose name were Hussein, but he was quite unique. And I said, what happened? He said that Akbar Musayyipur and Sadiqi, they will return tomorrow. So stay here. And I told him, why are you saying this? And he said, just wait here and stay here. It was almost 1 p.m. There was, we had a vision device, a special vision device, like a binocular, and they saw a dark object on the water, surface of the water. I took a look and I just saw a dark object on the surface of the water. They went to they went inside the water and they said it was Akbar Musayyipi. And the next day they found Sadiqi, and despite being tumultuous, the water had returned their bodies to their point of departure. They were both martyred, and the water returned the bodies of these martyrs to the point of origin. It was quite strange, and I asked Hussein, how come you knew this? And he said that I had a dream about Akbar Musayyipur. He told me that we were not captivated, we were martyred, and I will return tomorrow, and Sadiq will return the day after, the next day. And he told me something quite important. He said, you know why Akbar Musayyipur talked to me? It was from Sirjan. And Sadiq did not tell this to me. And I said, no. He said Akbar Musayyipur had two virtues. Firstly, he was married. And secondly, he performed his nighttime prayers while being in water. These were these two virtues of him that informed me. And Hussein was also later martyred. So at that, in those difficult times, one of the Hezbollah brothers, who was quite a virtuous man, he was an official in the south. According to him, he was not in a state of being asleep, and he said, I saw a lady. And there were two other ladies accompanying her. He said that while sleeping, I had the feeling that I've met Hazrat Zahra, peace upon her. I moved towards her feet. I told her in Arabic that see what is happening and see what sort of situation we are facing now. Hazrat Zahra said everything will be fine, and said that I was insisting to hold her feet, and I wanted to just ask her for something to make my demand, and suddenly she took out a handkerchief and just shook it and said everything's over. A moment later, an Israeli helicopter was hit by a missile, and the decline of the regime started. That means the regime's tanks were targeted. The first Cornet missiles were unveiled, and also the Israeli Merkava tanks that were not targeted, that had not been targeted, close to seven tanks were hit in a single day. Then Mr. Hamad Al Khalifa was the then foreign minister. And he acted as a mediator. He came to Lebanon, and he said this later. He said that in those days there was any talk of halting the conflict was not allowed. And he was at the UN. He said, I was disappointed. I went to my house to take a rest. And the malicious John Bolton came after me with anxiety and great deal of concern. And I asked him, has something new happened? He said, we have to go to the UN. And he said that when I arrived at the UN, I saw the Israeli ambassador walking with great deal of anxiety. And they both told me that the war has to be terminated and has to be halted now. They said that if the war is not halted, the Israeli army will be demolished. So they overlooked all their past conditions, and they were forced to accept the conditions set by the Hezbollah, and they accepted the ceasefire. And this was a major victory for the Hezbollah. In other words, it turned into a turning point. It became a turning point. And there was no other assaults by the Zionist regime on Lebanon, and this perception still exists, and the Hezbollah became more influential and put an end to the Zionist assault on Lebanon, and it put an end to Zionist assault on Lebanon, and after the 33-day war, the Ben-Gurion strategy in the preemptive war, and the offensive strategy of the Zionist regime, it gradually turned into a strategy for defense. And a few weeks ago, there was an event, and the Hezbollah threatened to target the Zionist regime to take revenge for these two martyrs. So the distance of within a distance of 3 to 5 kilometers, the Zionist regime fled from the zero point of border to the depth of 3 to 5 kilometers, and the Al-Mayadeen correspondent went on the other side of the barbed wire and said that I'm reporting to you from the occupied Palestine, and this has been the impact of the 33-day war. Thank you very much. As the last question, since we are commemorating the Holy Defense, how a bond has been created between the Holy Defense and the resistance movement? What is the bond? What sort of bond has been created between the Holy Defense and the resistance movement? Now, Imam Ali resorted to the Prophet of God, the Prophet of Islam, and when he writes a letter or performs a sermon, he resorts to the Prophet's tradition and behavior. This is the main foundation, the basic foundation. So at the time of Imam Ali, Imam Mujtaba, the chief of martyrs, Imam Hussein, they considered Imam Ali as the criterion, as a witness who has seen and who had practically put into practice the tradition of the Prophet. So this is the nature of the Holy Defense. So compared to other types of holy defenses, the Holy Defense plays a pivotal role and as a sacred nature. So we had the spiritual matters being crystallized and manifested in its most sublime status, and also we had the manifestation of one's beliefs in the purest way. Dedication, self-sacrifice, and also martyrdom, they were manifested in their in an excellent way. And also management, the relationship between a manager and the staff. So they can be compared to the rarest scenes at the time of the advent of Islam. Therefore, the Holy Defense can be considered as the climax, and these are like mountains leading to, for example, the climax, like Damavand Peak. Damavand Peak is the main peak in Alborz mountain range, but it is represented by Damavand Peak. So the Holy Defense can be compared to Damavand Peak, compared to the long Alborz range, mountain range. So it is the climax. And also, these are the form the mountain range, so that's how you can compare it.